Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from Troy's own Sanctuary for Independent Media. I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Chris Scully. We've got a full show ahead of us. Jewish Voices for Peace organized a protest last Friday at the Federal Building in Albany over the massacre of more than 60 Palestinians. Palestinians have been demonstrating at the fence enclosing Gaza for many years, asking for peace and civil liberties. We cover how they feel about the recent opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem and how it affects them.
Afterwards, WOOC correspondent Aaron Patinati sits down with Dan Nathan, the chair of Skidmore College's American Studies Department.
And then we'll hear from Nina Patterson and Phyllis Conroy about Troy's Hidden Garden Tour this Thursday. And after that, we feature a segment with Cassie Andrews and Ildefonso Apollons, who are our teachers at University of Albany, about how they worked with their students to produce radio pieces about race, class, and cultural identity.
And later on, we'll hear from Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books. He gives us tips and ideas about what books we should be reading as the summer rolls in. But first, we'll jump right into our headlines. The city of Saratoga Springs is working on opening up new bike lanes in Lake Avenue that will run from Lake Avenue Elementary School on East to I-87 Underpass. The city hopes to have them open and ready for riders by the time the Saratoga Race Course meet begins on Friday, July 20th.
New York State office campaigns are gearing up for the race in November. GOP gubernatorial candidate Mark Molinaro has chosen recent state Senate candidate Julie Killian to be his running mate for lieutenant governor. Molinaro has also picked up the Reform Party's nomination for governor. Green Party just this weekend nominated labor activist and socialist Howie Hawkins for governor and public school teacher Gia Lee for lieutenant governor. The Working Families Party tapped Cynthia Nixon for governor and city council member Jumani Williams for lieutenant governor. The Democrat and Republican conventions will be held later this week.
Women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia were arrested last week, just weeks before the nation lifts a ban on allowing women to drive. Several of the seven activists were jailed for leaders in the campaign to allow women to obtain driver's licenses, which the Saudi Arabian government approved last year. Five women and two men were detained on charges of, quote, suspicious contact with foreign parties and undermining the country's stability and social fabric.
A day after the Times Union reported on apparent fabrications in the professional biography of Upstate Medical University's chief of staff, the State University of New York School in Syracuse has placed the Sergio Garcia on leave. Garcia has been a $340,000 a year senior vice president and chief of staff since his appointment in March 2017. The school is Syracuse's region's largest employer.
Facebook now requires political advertisers to prove they're Americans by submitting their social security numbers. Facebook announced a crackdown on political advertising in early April, a move intended to soothe fears about political misinformation and election meddling. Among the changes, which will be fully implemented this week, Facebook will display who pays for political ads. The social network will also institute a complex process to verify purchasers of U.S. political advertising are in fact Americans or permanent residents living in America.
Bloomberg has reported China could potentially end its restrictions on the number of children. Allowed to live as soon as this year. China has enforced a policy that prohibits citizens from having more than one child for 40 years. This policy received widespread criticism and has resulted in 30 million more men than women due to selective abortions. Although the country has touted the policy for its economic successes, in 2015, the country opened up limits to two children in what was apparently an attempt to revitalize the workforce as it aged.
A recently built retaining wall behind the Stewart's shop located at the intersection of Hoosick Street and 10th Street collapsed, causing large concrete blocks to tumble down behind the store. No one was hurt in the collapse of the wall, the purpose of which was to hold up a 40-foot wall of dirt. Councilperson Anasha Cummings used the collapse as an opportunity to bring up the fact that the city of Troy doesn't have a city engineer, who would have overseen the construction of this wall and other public works. Currently, the city relies on contract engineers who are typically more expensive for such works. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's 105.3 FM's Hudson Mohawk Magazine, giving you news and views from around the Capital Region.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments or suggestions, you can text us at 518-888-3004. On Friday, Jewish Voice for Peace organized a protest at the federal building in Albany over the massacre of more than 60 Palestinians who were demonstrating at the border with Israel over the recent opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. WOOC interviewed Joe Lombardo of the United National Anti-War Coalition, Mark Mishler of the Jewish Voice for Peace, and Peter Lavenia of the Green Party.
We're talking with Joe Lombardo of the United National Anti-War Coalition, and there's a rally that sprung up in front of the federal building here in Albany related to the recent killings in Palestine. Joe, what's the focus of today's event?
Well, the recent killings in Palestine, as you mentioned, over 100 people have been killed and really thousands have been wounded and severely wounded. They've been using, the Israeli army has been using these butterfly bullets, which if they go into your arm and leg, they kind of explode, and it has led to many, many amputations. And they've been shooting down unarmed protesters that are protesting on their own land, which is Gaza, protesting for their rights and for freedom.
Well, the Trump administration claims this is just a bloody propaganda effort by Hamas to embarrass Israel. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, Malcolm X used to use the slogan that they make the victim into the criminal and the criminal into the victim. There's been no Israelis that have even been hurt in these demonstrations. They're just sitting on top of hilltops and other areas and taking pot shots at these demonstrators that have not been armed and are protesting for their rights. The Palestinians live in terrible situations. There are Jewish-only roads into Gaza. They only allow 1,600 calories per day per person. They don't allow people to leave, even if they get a scholarship to a college outside. They make their lives miserable. And don't these people have a right to protest that situation when this was their country from the very beginning? It was a country called Palestine, and the United States and other countries got together and gave it half over as a Jewish state. And today they've been kicking Palestinians out in large numbers until there's hardly any Palestinian territory left. So they have a right to protest, and I'm on the side of them when they do protest.
Now, you're out here in front of the federal building, which, of course, is the home, allegedly, of Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand, probably Congressman Tonko. How has our, you know, delegation in Congress reacted to the massacre?
Well, there have been 15 or 16 people in Congress who have made some kind of statement against the tactics of the Israeli government, but the vast majority in both the Democratic and Republican side have supported Israel, and you could see the way our ambassador to the United Nations has played a role in what Trump has done. A lot of this is due to the provocation he did when he moved the embassy to Jerusalem, which is a city which is jointly recognized by both Palestinians and Israelis, and it also is a very important place for Christians around the world. And to just do this in such a heavy-handed way was clearly a provocation, and it's led to the kind of situation that we've had. The U.S. has been supplying Israel with $3.5 billion per year of military aid and has been supporting them in their heavy-handed tactics. And Netanyahu is a bully, just like Trump is, and they find common cause in their bullying.
Well, I mean, Senator Schumer, of course, is the Democratic minority leader in the Senate, and Senator Gillibrand positioned herself as the left-wing Democratic candidate for president in a few years. Has Schumer and Gillibrand spoken out against the massacres?
No, not at all. And they lose all moral credibility by not doing that. They shouldn't be, in my opinion, supported by anybody.
And we've been talking with Joe Lombardo, head of the, or chair of the United National Anti-War Coalition. So next we're talking with Mark Mishler with Jewish Voice for Peace. Mark, what are some of the concerns about Jewish Voice of Peace of the recent massacre?
Well, Jewish Voice for Peace believes that what is necessary for peace in Palestine and Israel is for the human rights of Palestinians to be respected, that that is the starting point for peace. And that means that the occupation has to end and that Palestinians have to be granted, or that their full human rights have to be recognized by Israel and by the United States. And so this is not a problem of the past week or the past month. It's a problem that is a 70-year-old problem. What we've seen in this week in particular is a brutal escalation by the Israeli government with the strong and full support of our government, the United States government, for this brutal massacre of protesters in Gaza, which is in stark violation of international human rights and really of just any sense of common decency and morality. And the fact that our government not only supports that in words, but supports it with a heavy military aid support for the government of Israel means that this is our problem as well in this country. And what Jewish Voice of Peace stands for is that we as Jews, particularly American Jews, have a very distinct obligation to speak out and say that what the Israeli government does is not in our name, even though they claim that it is, and what our government, the U.S. government, does in support of Israel is not in our name, even though they believe that it is, and that what is happening, what the Israeli government does, is a contradiction to, I guess, if Jewish values or tradition means anything, then it means that we stand for human rights and we stand for peace and we stand for respecting everybody. And what the Israeli government does with the strong support of the U.S. is to violate those principles. So we're here as Jews to say this is not in our name, that we support Palestinians, we support Palestinian human rights, and we call for an immediate end to U.S. military support for Israel.
The United Nations human rights chief recently called this week for those killing the Palestinians to be held accountable. Are you optimistic that's going to occur?
Well, I think the United Nations has stood up very strongly against the objections over the years of the United States government, which has always backed Israel. So, I mean, the United States has veto power in the Security Council. It's difficult to get around that, but I think the United Nations does outstanding work in regard to Israel and Palestine, and we should support that work, and we should demand that the United States representative to the United Nations stop vetoing resolutions that would condemn Israel and would impose sanctions on Israel.
Thank you, Mark Mishler, Jewish Voice for Peace. Next, we're talking with Peter Lavigne, who is one of the state party co-chairs of the Green Party. Peter, why is the Green Party out here today protesting the recent massacre of Palestinians in Gaza?
You know, the Green Party stands with oppressed peoples around the world, and the Palestinian cause is one that is just. It's unfortunately something that Palestinians have been living with since 1948, and the United States has been aiding Israel in massacring Palestinian civilians, both by providing military aid, by providing essentially cover in the UN, even though there have been many, many sanctions of what's going on in Palestine and attempts, at least at that level, to work towards some kind of peace. Each time something seems like it might happen, the United States and Israel torpedo that process and then blame it on the Palestinians. We can see the same thing is happening today, where a couple of days ago, Donald Trump's envoys in Ivanka and Jared went to Jerusalem to open the embassy, even though the rest of the world said that this was a terrible idea to recognize Jerusalem, which is claimed by both the Palestinians and the Israelis, and that it was going to cause massive protests. And when these protests, I think, rightfully happen, the Israelis gunned down women, men, and children in cold blood. And so we say, you know, it's time to end U.S. support for Israel. It's time to support the Palestinian cause, support the Palestinian right right to statehood and an end to the oppression in Gaza and the West Bank?
You know, I know this issue has evolved over time, but does the Green Party have a position at this present moment on a two-state or a one-state solution?
You know, there's been conversation within the party on a two-state and one-state solution, and I think at this point in time, we do believe in a two-state solution. But, you know, there's been constant conversation because it seems like Israel does not really want to see an independent Palestinian state. So at some point in the future, it may be the case that the only option is going to be, you know, a democratic state in that area that is secular and is there for both Palestinians and Jews and anyone, really.
We've been talking with Peter Lavigne, co-chair of the Green Party of New York State, and this is Mark Dunley for WOOC.
That was WOOC's report on the Jewish Voice for Peace protest over the killing of more than 60 Palestinians and the wounding of several thousand by the Israeli military. A quick correction, the Palestinians that were killed last week were not protesting at a border wall, as Gaza is essentially an open-air prison within the State of Israel.
Thank you for that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Let us know how much you liked our last segment. If you had some issues with it, we'd like to know that too. Text us at 518-888-3004. WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati recently sat down with Dan Nathan, the chair of Skidmore College's American Studies Department, to ask him about a course that he teaches on HBO's The Wire. In this course of their conversation, Dan explained the relevance of The Wire to social and political issues in the Capital Region of New York State.
I'm Aaron Pednati, and today I'm interviewing Dan Nathan, the chair of the American Studies Department at Skidmore College, about the course that he teaches on HBO's The Wire. Dan is the author of the award-winning book Saying It's So, A Cultural History of the Black Sox Scandal. He is the editor of Baltimore Sports, Stories from Charm City. He's also the recipient of several honors, including a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship and a Fulbright Fellowship. Dan, thanks for talking with me today. It's good to be interviewing you.
It's my pleasure.
So to start out, can you give us a general sense of what The Wire is about and explain why it's the sort of show to which college courses are devoted?
Of course. The Wire was a HBO show. It aired for 5 seasons. And to understand what it is, I think it's important to back up and create just a little bit of context about the show's runner, its primary producer, and his name is David Simon. David Simon's background is journalism. He worked for the Baltimore Sun for many years, and at one point in his career at the Baltimore Sun, he basically got a year's paid leave to go follow homicide detectives around for the year to become kind of a fly on the wall and write about what they saw on their job, which is a very difficult job, of course, in a city like Baltimore, which has a lot of homicides, hundreds of them every year. So he wrote that book. It was called Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets. And it was optioned and produced by Barry Levinson and Tom Fontana. And David Simon worked on that show as a writer. And that show really taught him about how to produce his own television show. Soon thereafter, he co-wrote another book with a man named Ed Burns. Ed Burns had been a homicide detective for 20 years. Before that, though, he had been in Vietnam. After his career as a police detective, he became a public city school teacher. And the two of them worked on a book. It's called The Corner, and it's about how people in an impoverished community, some of whom are addicted to drugs, how they deal with that situation. So they were looking at the drug war from the perspective of its victims. So Burns and Simon wrote The Corner, which was later turned into a HBO miniseries, which David Simon co-produced. It was a big hit. I think it won some awards, including a Peabody. That TV experience made him think about another story he wanted to tell. And so he pitched to HBO. He pitched this narrative about how police and drug dealers interact.
For those just tuning in, I'm Chris Kelly.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. That last segment was Aaron Pednati speaking with Dan Nathan about The Wire. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
If you have comments, suggestions, or just want to give a shout out, you can text us at 518-888-3004. 3004. Don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
In our next segment, WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with University at Albany's professor Cassie Andrews and Idefonso Apollens, both of whom teach in the Department of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies. They worked with their students to produce radio pieces about race, class, and cultural identity that will be airing every week right here on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We're really excited because not only are you here, but you're here to announce a new collaboration with WOOC and the University of Albany. Can you describe the project that you had your students working on this semester?
So this year, Ilde and I wanted to do something with our students where we could get them using class themes, class concepts, and class readings out in the real world. So really making what's happening in their day-to-day life cohesive with what we're learning in class. So themes such as race, gender, what it means to be Latino or Latina here in the Capital District, and talking with community members in addition to students on campus just to learn more about student life here in the Capital District.
Yeah, and somehow we are looking at how what's the immigrant experience, what is like here in the Capital Region, considering that we are not in a big city and that this is sort of like a mix of suburban as well as city, and then not so far away from here, you have rural communities as well. So it's a very interesting mix in terms of the geography of our region. Mm-hmm. And so we encourage our students to not only engage with one another through what Cassie has presented in her class, but also as to going out into other areas of Albany outside the university and thinking about what's the life for those Latinos and Latinas living in this area like, considering also the socio-political context in which we have today.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What are the classes that you were teaching?
So I'm in ALCS 100. It's called Culture and Power in the Americas. It's sort of a buffet for everything that we teach in the LACS department. So we cover about 500 years of history from the encounter to today. And we look at identity, culture. We look at colonialism, imperialism, U.S. intervention. We also look at immigration and current events today. And what's great, being like a buffet class for the LACS department, the students themselves are a great mixture of SUNY Albany students. So we have a lot of, you know, Latinos and Latinas. We have students that identify as Afro-Latino or Black or just Caribbean, but white students as well. So it's a great mix of people to work with.
Yeah, in my case, I teach U.S. Latinos or Latinos experience in the United States, Latinas and Latinos in the U.S. It's a 200-level class, and so it really explores how the experiences of Latinos and Latinas in this country have been shaped historically and also due to the current events that we also look at. So we go and look at how immigration policies have shaped our country and therefore the experience of Latinos across the United States, how those experiences also are not the same. We also look at the different groups that usually are known as Latinos, so Mexican Americans, Cubans, Americans, Dominican Republic, Puerto Ricans, and how in many different ways those experiences are not the same experiences. And when we use Latinos or Latinas as a term, it encompasses somehow a sense that everyone is the same when in fact, we are not all the same in terms of the groups. Even within the groups, there are remarkable differences that are shaped by immigration policies, political context, history, and how people interact, and also the issues of race for Afro-Latinos in general, and also how those issues are also similar to other minority groups, like African Americans as well. So it's a class that takes a look at the history as well as the politics, the culture, and how we and where why we are where we are now as well.
Fascinating. So we're going to be hearing a different segment every Monday going forward and forever on our website, mediasanctuary.org. What did you task the students with? What did they produce for us?
So in my class, students were tasked to interview a fellow student. I organized pairs and trios at random in the hopes that maybe we were talking with people you wouldn't normally be talking with outside of the classroom or in your like normal day-to-day friendships. And I wanted them to interview each other on what is it like to be blank, you know, in the Capital District or at SUNY Albany, the blank being, you know, how they identified, if it was an Afro-Latina or as a black male or as a white woman, and share their experiences with each other using class themes, class readings, with the goal of getting them to feel more comfortable about talking sometimes about taboo subjects like culture, race, gender, sexuality, and really form well-developed opinions and then back those up with academic sources we have in class.
We're speaking here with Cassie Andrews, who you just heard, and also Ildefonso Apollon, who's about to tell you what his students at the University of Albany did in their collaboration with WOOC.
My students, in similar ways, they were tasked to find individuals who will be willing to be interviewed by them, and mostly were also of Latina origin, and most of the time near or through the university, but also some of them went outside the university and interview people that are in our community as well, so that they were able to find the experiences that they see and they study through the books and the documentaries that we watch, how those experiences correlate or not to the individual experiences that people have right here in our region, in our area. And also to, in one case, we interviewed someone who was from Spain, and so that gave the thought of what does Latino mean, what does Hispanic means, and who is under those terms. And so that was also fascinating to see the how we frame the categories of the other is a way of sort of saying who is part or not part of certain groups as well. So
interesting. Well, as somebody who doesn't get onto the SUNY Albany campus all that often, I feel it's so interesting when I walk through there because there's such a diverse population. And it's a little bit invisible for folks in the capital region. I think a lot of them maybe don't have cars and spend a lot of their lives on campus and in the nearby areas. So this will be a window on their world. We can pry the lid of their heads up and look inside and see what they're thinking at an early age. Who are these students? How old are they? Where are they from? What are they like?
So my students are a mix of freshmen, sophomore, and juniors, so anywhere from 17, 18 to about 20, and a huge mix of concentrations. So everyone in my class is either biology, homeland security, some are lax majors, some are art majors, so I think that makes the conversations that you'll be hearing really fun.
Yeah, in my case, similar to Cassie's class, I had students from primarily four or five different concentrations, biology majors, communication majors, journalism, some lax students as well, also homeland security majors. It's a new major that is increasing the number of students that I have seen in my particular class. And speaking with some faculty members from that department, they are very pleased to see that our students are getting a historical background on lax that otherwise has not been traditionally done in high schools. And that is an important background to have for the Homeland Security Department as far as the studies is concerned. But we also have students from majors from nursing as well as psychology. So it's a very interesting mix that comes together to our class. And even though we tend to have, in my particular class, less students from that are not from a Latino or minority background, it's always beneficial when we have in my class students who might be from white backgrounds in terms of the ethnicity or race, so that they give us another vision and another view of what they perceive. What is, I think, true for Cathy's and my class is that most of our students don't receive this type of education throughout high school. And what we offer in our classes are very unique in terms of that new knowledge that they receive as, in many cases or most cases, new. I don't know if you think so.
Yeah, in LACS we really pride ourselves on looking at alternative histories, so from the perspective of people of color or from immigrants or from women. And I think some students are really shocked and sometimes empowered by those histories because we're kind of used to the, you know, white male perspective of, you know, the historical figures that we're most common with from high school education.
Well, we only have a few moments left, but I wonder if you can summarize the students' experience doing the audio pieces. How are they feeling about doing radio?
Ooh, at first, they were very nervous about it, recording themselves and then listening to themselves and trying to figure out how to speak better. So a lot of my students were saying, I didn't realize how much I used like or or I didn't realize how low my voice was or how high it was. Yeah. So I think giving them a chance to really be self-reflective on how they speak is a super important tool going into the job market. In addition, I think they were also excited to just share their stories. It's very empowering. Sometimes as a student, we're so used to reading about other people all the time. It was really nice to sort of put them front and center and let them know that they'll be on the radio and people will hear their stories.
Yeah, I think they were a little bit shocked by that for the most part. They're like, seriously, are you serious about this? So, but it was a good experience, and they liked the opportunity to meet new people in settings that otherwise they would have not have been meeting. So.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of my students grow really nice friendships who they didn't know each other in the beginning of the semester and who are now, like, helping each other out with the final projects. So. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Cassie Ildefonso, thank you so much for coming today. Thanks so much for organizing your students to do this. Yeah. Really excited to hear some of their work.
That was WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce speaking with University at Albany professors Cassie Andrews and Ildefonso Apollons. Their students' radio productions about race, class, and cultural identity will be airing every week right here on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And unfortunately, our earlier segment had some technical difficulties, so we're going to be replaying the entire segment for you. But it was featuring Skidmore College's American Studies Department Chair Dan Nathan, recorded by producer Aaron Padnati, about the course that he teaches on HBO's The Wire.
I'm Aaron Pednotti, and today I'm interviewing Dan Nathan, the chair of the American Studies Department at Skidmore College, about the course that he teaches on HBO's The Wire. Dan is the author of the award-winning book Saying It's So, A Cultural History of the Black Sox Scandal. He is the editor of Baltimore Sports, Stories from Charm City. He's also the recipient of several honors, including a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship and a Fulbright Fellowship. Dan, thanks for talking with me today. It's good to be interviewing you.
It's my pleasure.
So to start out, can you give us a general sense of what The Wire is about and explain why it's the sort of show to which college courses are devoted?
Of course. The Wire was a HBO show. It aired for 5 seasons. And to understand what it is, I think it's important to back up and create just a little bit of context about the show's runner, its primary producer, and his name is David Simon. David Simon's background is journalism. He worked for the Baltimore Sun for many years. And at one point in his career at the Baltimore Sun, he basically got a year's paid leave to go follow homicide detectives around for the year to become kind of a fly on the wall and write about what they saw on their job, which is a very difficult job, of course, in a city like Baltimore, which has a lot of homicides, hundreds of them every year. So he wrote that book. It was called Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets. And it was optioned and produced by Barry Levinson and Tom Fontana. And David Simon worked on that show as a writer. And that show really taught him about how to produce his own television show. Soon thereafter, he co-wrote another book with a man named Ed Burns. Ed Burns had been a homicide detective for 20 years. Before that, though, he had been in Vietnam. After his career as a police detective, he became a public city school teacher. And the two of them worked on a book. It's called The Corner, and it's about how people in an impoverished community, some of whom are addicted to drugs, how they deal with that situation. So they were looking at the drug war from the perspective of its victims. So Burns and Simon wrote The Corner, which was later turned into a HBO miniseries, which David Simon co-produced. It was a big hit. I think it won some awards, including a Peabody. That TV experience made him think about another story he wanted to tell. And so he pitched to HBO. He pitched this narrative about how police and drug dealers interact with each other, how the war on drugs looks from different perspectives. And he did it in a unique, novel way in that he humanized everyone. The drug dealers aren't stereotyped. They're not caricatures. They're not even archetypes. They're human beings. They have strengths. They have weaknesses. They have flaws. They have depth. And it's a really rich story. So then what he did after the first season of that is he added four other seasons, and each season follows a different institution. The second season focuses on longshoremen, stevedores, what happens to blue-collar labor when work goes away, right? When industrialism is replaced with post-industrialism and people have to confront that new economic and social reality. The third season focused on City Hall, about local politics. And all the while, those characters he developed in the first season are still in play. Some, of course, have fallen by the wayside because, you know, it's a violent trade and some characters are murdered or imprisoned. But basically, the characters he developed in the first season are ongoing, and the characters he developed in the second season, to a lesser extent, are ongoing in this narrative. So the third season is on City Hall. The fourth season is about inner city public education. And the fifth season focuses on the Baltimore Sun, the institution that he used to work for. In every case, he's showing institutional dysfunction and how they affect real people, that is, you know, his characters. So it's a complex skein of narratives. You really need to see the whole thing. It's a serial narrative. You can't just dip in and out of it. In order to understand what The Wire is really about, you need to watch all 60 episodes in order.
So based on your own experience of teaching a course about it, how can The Wire help students to grasp the complexities of the topics that it covers in its storylines, and how can its way of dealing with these topics supplement more traditionally academic ways of teaching about them?
You have to begin, of course, with it as a narrative. That is, students are automatically, perhaps even naturally, inclined to come at it first as a story. They need to understand the story, what happens to whom and why. Who are the characters? What are the relationships? Who survives and who does not? After we've figured out, you know, what really happens in the story, then you can stop, pause, reflect, think, discuss about, well, what does it mean? How does it illustrate what are sometimes abstract concepts like globalization or neoliberalism? And the show is really rich. It doesn't just, in some ways, supplement disciplinary understandings of these things. It actually illustrates them richly. The scholarship on The Wire is really rich. It's ongoing. There are many sociologists. There are urban historians. There's anthropologists, economists. And they all understand that The Wire is basically trying not just to tell a story, although that is part of it, but that it's a series of arguments, that the show has actually multiple theses. And one of the writers, Ralph Alvarez, who came to my class this semester, he lives in Baltimore, he says the show is actually a series of indictments. And these institutions that Simon is interrogating and critiquing are deeply flawed and are having real effects on the characters. And so The Wire humanizes a whole series of complicated issues that otherwise can easily get lost in abstraction or just mere theory. The Wire doesn't allow that to happen because it's so much rooted in what seem to be like real people and in a rich, seemingly authentic historical and contemporary context.
When I was going to grad school at NYU, I knew a PhD student in sociology who told me she couldn't get her parents to understand structural arguments for poverty until she got them to watch The Wire. When she'd explain it to them in the language that she was learning as a grad student, the ideas didn't resonate with their own experiences and their sense of the world. But when they saw the same type of arguments play out in a series of stories that depict the extremes of poverty, it started to make sense to them. Have you ever seen anything similar with your own students? And more generally, can you tell us about the ways they've reacted to the show?
You know, students, their reactions are quite varied, and they come at it from so many different angles. Some of them have never seen it. Some of them have seen it multiple times. Some of them enrolled in the class in part because their parents urged them to do so. Their parents had seen the show and thought highly of it. One of my favorite moments in this class, I've taught it a couple times now, was when a student, when we were introducing ourselves, he said that he had seen the show all the way through twice before and that he was envious of his classmates who had not yet seen it because he yearned to see it for the first time through fresh eyes. the reactions are really great. And I think that experience you're talking about with your NYU student makes sense to me in that there are some complicated theoretical abstract ideas that are just better expressed, better illustrated through narrative. And students, after they understand what the narrative's about who is who and what are their relationships to other people, their wire literacy is incredibly high. There's something about this narrative that really resonates with them, and they remember and, in fact, know elements of the show so well. It's like they've read a really good novel and remembered almost all of it, and sometimes in amazing detail. That's important because once you know the show really well, then you can take that next step and talk about the larger issues. David Simon sometimes gets agitated, right, when people watch the show and just like it as a narrative, when he's really trying to make cultural criticism. He's really trying to offer social critique. He wants us to appreciate the show for the political and sociological arguments he's making. And if you don't appreciate it in those terms, he's somewhat agitated. But my point is, so what? Everyone's going to come to this show from a different place, and they're going to take different things about the show with them. And that's one of the reasons why it's such a great text. It's so rich. It's so open for analysis. It's so multifaceted that regardless if you're a sociologist or a historian or an anthropologist or economist, you're going to see something in The Wire that makes a great deal of sense to you.
Okay, last question. Despite the fact that it's very focused on the city of Baltimore, Maryland, do you think that The Wire contains any lessons that are also applicable to the capital region of New York State? In particular, how would you compare the state of Baltimore as depicted in the show to that of Albany, Schenectady, and Rensselaer counties in real life? And how might The Wire be used to reflect on and address local social conditions?
That's a very good question. David Simon produced a show about a city that he knows very well. He has a great deal of affection for, and there's no doubt about it. One of the strengths of the show is that the city becomes a character. They shot it on location. They go out of their way to make prominent landmarks visible in the show. They try the best they can to use local vernacular. It's clearly about Baltimore. So much so, of course, that some local officials weren't real appreciative of the show because they thought it depicted the city in less than flattering light, which is true because the show is rooted in social reality. At the same time, David Simon said, look, I don't have to make this show here. I could make it in Cleveland, just call it Baltimore. He could have said it in all kinds of places. It could have been Cleveland, Detroit, Buffalo, Gary, Indiana, Flint, Michigan. It could have been all kinds of places that are suffering from poverty, under and unemployment, drug abuse, problems between the police and its community members, police brutality. All these things are common in cities all over the country, including, of course, here in the Capital District. Many of these problems are the kinds of things that are taking place in Albany and Troy and Schenectady and Rensselaer. Anytime you have a community like Schenectady that was really predicated on a really big employer like General Electric, when GE pulls up and the community loses thousands of jobs, these kinds of problems ensue. So while it is about Baltimore, you can definitely make parallels, make connections between what's going on in The Wire and what's going on in scores of other American cities.
Well, that sounds like a good reason that we should watch it. Thanks again for this interview, Dan. It was very nice talking with you.
It was my pleasure.
That was WOOC's correspondent Aaron Pettinati speaking with Dan Nathan about The Wire.
The 19th annual Hidden Garden Tour takes place this Thursday in Troy. WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce spoke to two of the organizers, Nina Patterson and Phyllis Conroy.
Tell us, what is the Hidden Garden Tour? Sounds very secretive, is it?
No. It's the talk of the town.
In the 1800s, when houses were built in Troy, they had horses and carriages. And so in the back of each house is a carriage house. And there was a green space that was used for the walkway between the house and the carriages. And so nowadays, these carriages have become our garages. And that space that you walk through on your way to the garage is what we call our hidden gardens. In the early days, they hung laundry up in that area, and most of us have dryers now, so there's not much laundry hung out. But the house, it's a perfect space. I forget what they say the average 10 by 20
Yes.
Feet.
Yeah, 15 by 20.
And they're rarely seen by anybody but the homeowner. And as they travel from the house to the garage, and some people have done a lot of plantings and some haven't. And once a year, the homeowners open up their doors to allow visitors in these spaces, and we call that the Hidden Garden Tour. Of course, there are side yards and backyards that are not bounded by the houses or garages, and they are also featured on the tour. Nina, did you want to say?
Yes, you know, you drive along 2nd Street or any of the streets in downtown Troy, and all you see are the facades of houses. Beautiful, beautiful houses, and Victorian houses mostly, and have no idea that there's anything in back of them. Well, I was so surprised when I bought my house in 1987. I was taken in to the front door, and I knew instantly because of the mahogany railing going up the stairs that it was my house. And then she took me to the through the little kitchen and out the back door, and there is this gorgeous garden. I thought, oh, that's beautiful. And then I said, who owns that building back there, referring to a red brick building? She said, that belongs to the property, too. That's the carriage house. Well, nobody knew about the gardens. So I decided pretty soon that we've got to show off our gardens. I invited everybody I knew to come and see the garden, not the house so much, but the garden. And they said, people got to know about this. So it started. I met Peter Grimm. Peter Grimm is the guru of Prospect Park.
And your neighbor.
And a neighbor, yes. And we became very good friends, and we're talking about the gardens. He also had a space in back of his house. And, well, he said, in talking about it, he said, well, we can sponsor it by Prospect Park and have friends of Prospect Park. So, and we decided that that we really had to charge something. We really didn't think much about that, but we said, okay, we'll charge $10 a ticket, and so which we still do. And as long as I'm alive, it's going to be $10 a ticket. So we do raise money. We raise a considerable amount of money because we have a lot of people coming. We come in rain, shine, wind, tornado, literally tornado. Sunny shines. It's going to be sunny this week. It's going to be sunny, beautiful weather.
Excellent. So that's very interesting. I did not know the genesis of this whole project.
So good. I hope everybody listening is going to hear about it.
Oh, yes. Well, I think people are hearing about it a lot. This is actually one of the things that's so fascinating. It's the 19th annual, and it seems to really have become a fixture in the Troy scene, which is exciting. What was the idea behind starting it in the first place?
To show it off, to let people know that it existed. People other than just our intimate friends who were coming to see our gardens, to let people know about the livability in downtown Troy. In fact, I know two people who actually bought houses because of the gardens in downtown Troy. They had no idea that they would be able to garden there. A lot of people want to have outside space. And this was not only outside space, it was perfect space for a garden.
I lived for a number of years in New Orleans, and it was a well-known fact that that each house had a carriage house or slaves' quarters in some cases behind them, and beautiful gardens in between. And everybody knew about that, and it was some of the restaurants took advantage of it and so forth. I was very surprised to hear that Troy had that same thing. So I think you're right that it was a very unknown feature and something that really distinguishes Troy. Do the houses in Albany of the same vintage have the same thing?
No, one of the things that gives us the advantage over the houses in Albany is that we have alleys. And when people come to this garden tour, they walk up and down the alleys where the gardens open up their gates into the alleys.
I see. So you don't have to track through somebody's house
We encourage people not to open their houses.
I see.
So they sit out and back, and sometimes they offer lemonade and cookies, or sometimes they offer more than that. It depends on who they are and what they want to do. But their gardens are open to the alleys, except for the ones, as you say, Phyllis, on the I don't know whether you did say it or not.
Yeah, there are some that are not bounded by the backyards, and so they can come in. Some houses have double lots, so their garden is in the back and also extends out to the side. So we have all sorts of different...
If you have a moment when we're finished with this interview, I'll have to show you the Sanctuary for Independent Media's garden. We have a carriage house with no house, so the entire lot is filled with a large garden. So we're here at T-minus 1 or 2 days before the Hidden Garden Tour, the 19th annual. We're speaking with Phyllis Conroy and Nina Patterson. They're talking about what's become a fixture in the Troy area, Thursday's Hidden Garden Tour, sponsored by the Friends of Prospect Park. Now, how do people go about participating in this?
Well, if you are a homeowner, we send out a letter in, I think, March or April and ask for those who... So first of all, we check with everyone who's been on it in the past and see whether they want to be on it again. And then word goes out that we might have openings for other gardens. So that's essentially how they get notified, and that's how they become involved.
And how does the average person or even the above average or below average person take this all in? What happens on Thursday? What do I need to do? I've never been on this tour. What do I have to do?
Well, there are signs that will be put up at some of the main entrances of the city.
All hot pink, yes. Look for the hot pink signs.
Yes. They direct them to the parking lot. It's a Sage parking lot at the corner of First and Division. And there's gardens, the garages or carriage houses that are now garages that open up onto the alleyway. We'll have a couple of tents there, and you'll see exactly where you buy your ticket, and you get a program/map that has all of the gardens that are to be seen this year.
Is it possible to bicycle through the tour?
Yes, you could certainly take a bicycle.
And is it all within walking distance? If you park your car one spot and then you can walk the rest of the way?
Exactly. You park your car, you buy your ticket, you get a map, and you start walking. So I don't know exactly how many steps or miles it is, but we've got 34 gardens, so it could take most people a good hour. Depending on how much time they spend in each garden, it could take them the whole time from 4 to 7:30 to see all of them.
And that's only a glimpse. Last year there was, as far as I know, or as far as anybody told me, we had 33 gardens, I think, last year. And one person came and said, you know, I saw all the gardens, but she said I ran.
And are there... are there differences from year to year? Have you been one year? Is it incumbent upon you to come back again to see changes?
I think every year we invite the same people, but people move. Life happens, and so some people decide not to be on the tour, and then it seems as though the same number that may step off will step on. So we've got a new urban farm coming up this year, and one of the churches, St. Paul's Church, which has beautiful gardens in their Tiffany windows, will be open. So there's always new things coming on.
And is there food and drink involved as you go from garden to garden? Do people do that?
Not coming from the Friends of Prospect Park, not coming from us, but coming from individuals, garden owners. Sometimes they want to do that. Sometimes they don't. And whatever they want to do within the confines of their garden, they're welcome to do.
Great.
There's also a rest stop and a place you can get refreshments at Carmen's Cafe, which is on the corner of Adams and First Street. Carmen's has been involved with us right from the very beginning. So that's a good spot to know about for refreshments. And
you asked about if the gardens change from year to year. Yes, sometimes they do, and sometimes people come back to see what they saw last year that they liked, or to see if you've made any changes in your garden. Mine always was the first garden on the tour, so people would always come in and say, oh, I see you've got new iris there, or I see, oh, what happened to the forget-me-nots? I used to have forget-me-nots. And so they liked taking notes and making comments about that. And then other people really wanted to go and see new gardens that they hadn't seen at all. So no wonder. That's what I'm going to do this year. My job is to hang around and schmooze.
Nina has a story about a couple that moved in and they they were very brave. They opened up the garden as they were just shortly after they had moved in, and it was in... Why don't you tell the story, Nina?
Oh, yes. Some people across the street from me moved in, and I asked. I went over to call on them, and I was telling them about the Hidden Garden Tour. And would you... I knew they had a space in back of their house. So they said, oh, no, it looks like a bomb site. It's terrible. There are rocks around. There are trees falling down. I said, that is perfect, just perfect. And they were brave enough to put their... to list their garden on the map and to have their garden on the tour, which the next year they had done so much work and had improved it so much that when people came to see it, they were astounded. And I think it gave a lot of people the inspiration and the hope that you could do stuff in back of the gardens, no matter what you got stuck with in the beginning. I like to tell people that it's the nicest thing. And when I say nice, I mean pleasantest thing that happens in downtown Troy. People, hundreds of people, literally hundreds of people. Last year we counted 700 people on this tour, and they were walking in the alleys, talking to each other, smiling, comparing notes about flowers. No, I didn't think anybody was talking about politics or unpleasant things. They were just having a good time outdoors, and it really is a cheerful, loving... Yes, loving, lovable, lovely thing to have in a city.
The Downtown Business Improvement District in Troy has gotten on board, and if many of them are going to be providing discounts or coupons and things, if you bring your pink program with you, and it will be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So bring your map. When you shop downtown, a lot of businesses, you'll get a list as you check in. A lot of businesses will be offering special coupons and special deals.
Well, thank you both for coming out.
You're
really
welcome.
Appreciate it. It's a beautiful day to be indoors, and we appreciate the sacrifice.
Thank you.
Take care.
That was Nina Patterson and Phyllis Conroy. They recently spoke to WOC correspondent Steve Pierce about the 19th annual Hidden Garden Tour, which takes place this Thursday starting at 4 p.m. in Troy.
Well, that concludes our show. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Chris Scully. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or the sudden urge to express your gratitude, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in at 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 FM is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. We'd love to have you. We don't bite, we promise. You can be involved in many different ways. You can engineer, like our engineer tonight, Jonah Moberg. Thank you, Jonah, for being such a great engineer. You can be a host like me or my friend here. Or you can produce pieces like the ones you heard earlier on the show. There is a ton of ways to get involved, and we'd love to have you. But meetings are held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media on Monday nights at 7:07, right after this show is recorded live. But until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.